Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
Happy day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 176 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
And would you believe, faithless listeners, well, the more regular of you will believe this because it happens every first podcast that we do in January, that's 2 days ago, on the 15th of January, was our podcast's 9th birthday.
That can't be right. I'm not 9 years old yet.
We've designed a non-agonal advent crown, just specially.
Beautiful.
9 years, bloody hell.
9 years. Do you know what? I think I remember listening to the first episode. It was on my school walk. I was walking to school. I had my exams ahead of me. I had life ahead of me.
Rub it in.
I'd just done work experience at the local shop. And then I thought, oh, what's this diddly dumb? I'll try this out.
Cool. When I grow up, I'll be just like him.
And I got detention for listening to the first episode. You know, it was just...
Oh, because you didn't have your headphones plugged in properly.
Yeah, it's like your friend on the bus.
Right, so, happy birthday to all.
Happy birthday to
what
us.
What has been happening? As much more exciting and interesting as the production notes in DWM have become since the return of Russell T. Davis, I don't think there was much of great moment in them recently, was there? They have confirmed that it will be 3-hour-long specials, which will explode onto our screens from November 2023 before Shooty and Millie debut in a fourth special over Christmas and New Year. So it will all be squashed into between November and New Year.
Mm. And I think, is he confirmed there'll be 8 episodes in the first series with Shooty?
I think he has, hasn't he?
Yes.
Something like that.
And then he also promised to sort of condense the waiting time between series. But he said the Empire wasn't built in a day, is I think what the term that he used in...
Yes, something like that, yeah.
Which Empire, though? Was it the Trigon or the Roman?
The Iron.
Or the Iron. That's topical, Mark.
No, I'm not discussing the Iron's football team.
We've all ordered our copies of Warp Warp 5. Links in the show notes, of course, if anyone wants to know how to order them. So we're always looking forward to that, talking of the Iron Legion. Mark and Hayden, just before we started recording, you were brandishing gleefully, you gloaters, some little trinkets that you've come across recently, haven't you? I thought, let's share it all with the listeners. So Hayden, you were starting, weren't you? What did you come up with?
Well, 3 or 4 days before Christmas, I had the day off. Oh, hang on 1 second. William's not settling. I can hear him in the other room. Sophie's just gone in. It might be because he can hear me.
I can't hear him.
No, but I can hear him, and I think he might be able to hear me, which is why he's not going to sleep. 1 second, sorry. Hang on a minute.
Yeah, no, that's right.
Muzak, please, computer.
Apparently he was woken up by an airplane, and he keeps saying airplane in the sky, so that's the reason why he heard it. Sorry.
Oh, well, okay.
Yeah, a few days before Christmas, I took the day off and went to a place called Sawbridgeworth in Hertfordshire, which is close to where my mum grew up.
Ah.
And she's well acquainted with this place called, I think it's like Sawbridgeworth Antique Centre, I think it's called. Mind-bogglingly big. It's like a village, let alone a centre. Utterly insane how many like little antique shops there are sort of tucked in this industrial estate. And myself and my mum, we spent the entire morning looking around what we thought was the main shop. Went to the pub at lunch and then realised we hadn't even touched it, essentially. It was like seven stories high. Like, literally, like, one of the most incredible places I've ever seen. And in there, they had three or four, like, toy departments, I'd say.
Cool.
It was so good. Ooh. And not only that, but they had, behind display cases, they had Marvel toys. And then they had the Gerry Anderson toys. And my mum bought a super-sized Thunderbird 1 for William for Christmas Day. So he had that, which makes it makes noises and all the rest of it. You can put like figures in it. It's amazing. It's the kind of thing I wish I'd had when I was a kid.
Ruined my Christmas Day, I have to say.
Did it?
Oh, yeah, I was thinking. And I told everyone to make donations to charity instead. And you go, William, I get a picture of William waving his big toys around. And I was thinking, oh, I want big toys too. It's not fair. Quite disappointed, really.
Well, charity starts at home, Doc.
So, you were in this, was this a museum or an antique centre?
It might as well have been both, to be honest with you. Yeah. Some things were incredibly expensive. I mean, they had,
they had
film posters, and they had two Star Trek film posters. They had the motion picture, and they had First Contact, which is one of my favourite Star Trek films. And they were in display cases, and they were like £200 or something crazy like that. They had a Gibson Les Paul from the late 70s, I think it was. That was about 500 quid. And one of Paul McCartney's bassist guitars as well, Mark. So that's, it was pretty decent there, pretty decent. But there's some things which I could afford to buy. And there's a lot. I reckon about 75% of the stuff that I liked, I really had to pull myself away from buying. It was just insane the amount of stuff in there. They had a 1989 Tim Burton era Batmobile, which I remember distinctly playing with my cousin with. And it was just, I used to love playing with that, but it was like £30. I was like, if I buy this, it's not good. You know, William would have to play with it. And what's it going to, you know, I couldn't buy it basically. But what I did get, because I collect models and like corgi replicas of cars and other vehicles from shows that I like and TV and film.
Oh, I see. So not like Kate Moss.
I've got Naomi Campbell in my cupboard, but, you know, apart from that.
Ba-doom-tish.
My collection's growing. I'm hoping to get Linda Lusardi next week. So, in my top three favourite cars of all time is the Ford Gran Torino from Starsky and Hutch, which is in my hands right now.
Oh, marvellous.
That's the original.
Oh.
It's got springy suspension, which is just what you want for when you're chasing those crooks along the busy American roads. It's a bit yellow inside. The only bit that is a little bit damaged.
That's because they're smoking fags.
Yeah, from smoking fags. Yeah, there's the one thing that's missing is the little siren on top.
Yeah.
Isn't there, but I don't think that was a part of it
anyway.
Oh, the
little cherry thing. Yeah.
Also, was there a smaller version that had one of them leaning out of the car with a gun?
So, yes, there was. I do have the smaller version.
Oh, you jelly?
I think it was Hutch. Yeah, it's just over there. I would get it if we weren't recording, but... I'm actually missing that figurine. But then I also discovered, and this is to bring it back to Doctor Who related, I discovered Bessie...
Oh!
With a little... I'll just...
Tiny Tom!
With a little...
A little Tom in it, in the driving seat.
Yeah, it's Tom Baker. It's Burgundy Tom Baker, so it's season 18 Tom, so it's definitely not...
Not canon.
Definitely not canon. But you've got the Who one,
mm-hmm.
The license plate down here, got the wheels that turn around. It's... Oh, it's glorious. I love this.
Would that have been from that... Did they do a set where they had, like, TARDIS and stuff in it?
So, doing some investigating, I think it came in a set that was in a tin.
Yeah.
That was with a Davros, a K-9, a TARDIS, and I think it was Tom in the Season 18 outfit as well. Right. And it was like in a tyre, from what I can see on eBay. About 20 years old now. But yeah, I've got one of them. And also, for £5, I treated myself because out of all the stuff that my parents kept, the Star Wars toys that I had, apart from the Millennium Falcon, which is still up in my loft, they chucked out. Everything else they kept, all my Star Wars stuff, went the way of all flesh, unfortunately. So...
yeah, my stepdad threw all my Star Wars toys out when I moved out of the house without telling me. And I went back to look for them years later and found out that he'd, rather than put them in the attic, as I'd imagined, he'd actually taken them to the tip and just junked them. Absolute hound.
Well, some of us didn't have any Star Wars toys at all.
Oh.
Oh, well. You can borrow my Han Solo figure then, Doc. There we go. Yeah, he's taken up residency next to Thunderbird 3 and the DeLorean from Back to the Future on my shelf up there. So I'm looking at them lovingly. I'll share a picture in the show notes, ladies and gentlemen. But yeah, fantastic place. If any of us are ever able to meet up and go there, it would be incredible. Because you would need a day to look around, though.
And as ever, faithless listeners, you can find links to photos, videos, and more information on almost everything that we discuss on the Diddly Dum podcast at our podcast blog, which you can find at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. Mark's been sorting out a lot of old stuff in boxes to spring clean his new place, and he's been drooling over old albums, haven't you, Mark?
Old albums, yes. I found my Led Zeppelin Nebworth bootleg double albums. I found my Abbey Road original vinyl.
No, really?
Yes, I found so much Tom Jones, I was a bit shocked. But also, amongst it all, I found... ta-da!
No! The Genesis soundtrack!
Yeah. Wow. Genesis of the Daleks. Yeah, it's...
God.
That's somewhere in my mum's back bedroom there.
Boosie Records, look at that! It's in really... oh, it's pristine! That is a really good nick, actually. I'm absolutely delighted with it. So, Genesis of the Daleks... the 1979 LP in mono.
Wow. So was that a re-release then, Mark?
Yes, it is.
Mine was the original.
Hey, your Han Solo figure, are you sure it's one of the original Kenner figures?
Yeah, I've had it tested.
Oh, I accept without reservation the results of your excellent potassium argon test.
So did we get anything exciting for Christmas?
I got the Doctor Who annual. This year's annual.
Oh, right.
And I also got the Young Ones on Blu-ray.
Oh, lovely. Excellent.
I absolutely love. It's one of my favourite comedies, the Young Ones. It kind of trumps Bottom for me. See what I did there? It's got quite a nostalgic feel for me because I had the Young Ones on, like... do you remember, like, they did something very interesting with the VHS releases, the very early ones when they first came out. They put little, like, one-second clips of like nature films or something in the middle of the show.
That's subliminal.
They didn't broadcast it like that. Yeah, like subliminal. Have you heard of this, Mark?
Yeah. It's supposed to be illegal. Oh, it's supposed to be illegal to use it for advertising in films, I think.
I know Brass Eye did it during the last episode. Michael Grade has stepped in and said, yeah, actually, that sketch is too much for TV broadcast, and forced them to cut it. And so it was cut, and Chris Morris put a frame flashed very quickly on screen that if you could pause your recording of it quickly enough, you could see that it was Chris Morris standing in front of a map of Britain with the words, Michael Grade is a beep on it.
Something rude.
I've heard that, yeah. It was, they did something similar with these. They actually weren't allowed to broadcast them. They wanted to broadcast them with these little flash images in there. But I noticed watching Bambi, because they've left them in the Blu-ray, I noticed in Bambi that the little flash that they've put in is from the title sequence of Carry On Cowboy.
Random.
Very random, but that's what they did. It was just random bits that didn't make sense. They just wanted to put like a little Easter egg in for people who bought the videos, so they've done them on the Blu-rays as well. But ever since I read the article about the fifth housemate, which I've never mentioned on the podcast before.
Oh, yes. Mm, yeah.
Now I can't stop seeing this weird ring-like creature sitting just behind the, you know, in the corner of the frame and everything. Mm. It's all very bizarre. A bit creepy as well, but it's... I might add that to my, you know, You're Never Alone with the Swan. And good old Yellow Pages as things that scare the crap out of me. Mm. What else did I get? Yeah, and that was kind of it. I didn't really want any presents this year, so those two were very lovely. Thank you, everyone.
I got the DVD box set of the first five series of Give Us a Clue.
Oh! Wow!
Give Us a Clue. Is that the radio series with Graham Garland and Timber Taylor?
It's Lionel Blair and it's charades.
Oh, God.
Right. Celebrity charades.
It's all the Michael Aspel ones.
Mm.
Oh, it's the one Pip Madeley's been sharing. Lionel Blair. And he keeps introducing Lionel Blair.
Yes, of course, yeah. But you know how they used to... you'll have to take our word for this, Hayden. Do you remember how they used to... They'd say, oh, here's the thing you've got to mime. And it'd be something like, Wee Willy Winky. And the audience would all start giggling. They'd say, oh, that's going to be an embarrassing word to mime. How will a man mime a word like Willy? But there are people like Derek Griffiths off Play School. And here's the thing you got to mime, and it will come up on the screen. Multicoloured swap shop. And the audience will start giggling in the same way. As if, oh, have they given that to you because he's coloured?
Oh, no.
That's 1970s. And he actually wanted you to mime that. He actually stroked his own cheek. And I was thinking, you can't do this.
Oh, well.
4-3 to the fellas, and it's the fellas' turn. Derek Griffiths.
Oh,
well done, Derek. Here we go. Yes, your team wish you well. It's on the screen now if you want to look or not.
You will. Oh, Derek.
It's play away.
2 minutes from.
It's a. What is it? A film? A television. Television. How many words? Five words. Four. Four words. Four words. And a television. The first word or the fourth word? Last word. The fourth word. Shut that door.
A shop.
Shop.
Curiosity.
No, that's television. Something shop.
Are you being served? Shop.
Are you being served?
Shop.
Shop. Is the last word is shop? Yes. It's television.
That's how he goes home.
Derek, coloured. Coloured shop, there's something. The coloured. Multicoloured swap shop!
He was on a few weeks later and he got a whiter shade of pale. And I thought, oh no. That's just me coming up with this stuff. But the audience started giggling as childishly. I thought, bloody hell.
That's appalling.
You know, whenever they've got one of the clues is either China or Germany, you just bury your head in your hands because you know what the mime's going to be, just sticking one finger on your top lip and sticking your hand up in the air. The other's just, pulling the corners of your eyes out in there.
Oh, dear.
But otherwise, very educational, I found it. To be fair, those moments are vanishingly rare and don't typify the show at all, but the jaw does drop.
So I'll speak down your end of the wing to watch it with you.
I'll find something else to do that night.
Do you get anything interesting, Mark?
A few bits and bobs, but I'll spare you all the tedious details.
Hooray! So, has anything interesting been happening? The only thing we mentioned, did we, that day before Christmas Eve, so we won't have mentioned it before on the podcast. We lost Stephen Greif, didn't we?
Oh, God, yeah. Yes.
Who Mark and I saw at Normanton, didn't we, Mark?
Yeah, 2019.
At the Maximum Power Convention.
That's funny, isn't it? Because I remember us commenting on how well and like young and fit he looks for someone of his age. He looked in great shape, didn't he? So
Is this the original Travis?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
The better Travis.
The original and best Travis. Yeah.
Well, you know, there's things to enjoy about both of them, isn't there?
And this may even be too old for you, Mark. He also played the role of the sort of the gangster in Citizen Smith.
Oh, no, yeah, I remember Citizen Smith. I can't remember the gangster, though.
Harry.
Right.
Happy times.
Citizen Smith was written by John Sullivan, wasn't it?
Yes.
Who went on to write Any Fools and Horses. Yeah, okay, I know which one it is. Power to the People.
Yay!
Yeah, I know it, yeah.
Past president of the Stage Golfing Society. Why would you play golf on a stage? Have we any other news or anything else that's been happening that's interesting?
I watched Power of the Doctor twice over Christmas.
Oh.
I don't know whether that's interesting or more of a cry for help, you probably think. Know. But it was a... Yeah.
Why?
Why did I watch it twice?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think I was probably pining for the Christmas specials that have been and gone, and then I started pining for the New Year specials that have been and gone. We didn't have any this year, so I ended up watching it tonight. I don't know. I actually genuinely don't know why. Oh, hang on. No, I do remember why I watched it twice. It's because when it came to the shock that she was giving the companions with regards to implanting that hologrammatic thing in them, I went back to watch it again because I didn't remember her touching Tegan and Ace, but then she did, didn't she, that first scene where she met them. So, yeah. And then I just watched it again. Actually, do you know what? It kind of gets more enjoyable with every watch. And I've seen it like 4 or 5 times now, so...
Wow! That's bonkers.
Sad, isn't it?
Oh, well, good for you.
Oh, and I watched, obviously, the story that we're about to talk about today, but I watched The Green Death again. As well over Christmas.
Oh, now you're talking.
And that, I would love to do a deep dive in that sometime, because that is one of my favourites. What a story.
Have we done that one before? Did you do that one in the early days with, that was in the early, you did, didn't you? Pre-Hayden, I mean.
When I was but a little chick being hand-reared.
We did it in podcast 13. Where I think we were where the Rev gave us a rendition of his ballad that he wrote about the Green Death.
Yes.
But otherwise, I don't think we've done it since. So apart from Mark mentioning in podcast 92 that he'd watched it with Polly, no, I don't think we have. So I can give that a go sometime.
And it's part of the, obviously it's part of the Yeats trilogy, isn't it, as well?
Yes, of course.
Think that might be when we spoke about it a bit, yeah.
So, yeah, and actually Richard Franklin's still very unwell, isn't he? So I believe he sent some messages to people via a friend of his and Katie Manning yesterday, but yeah, he's not been...
Oh, was it his birthday the other day or something?
He's 87.
Yes, it was, yes.
87? I couldn't believe that. I thought he was younger than that.
I know, he looks so young in The Green Death, doesn't he?
He does, to be fair. He does.
You know, he does, yeah. So
he's in his 20s. He would have been in his 40s at that point. My God. Yeah, crazy. I wouldn't know what it's like to be in my 40s.
Well, as promised during our Christmas podcast that we would have to delay this, just before Christmas, a little closer to home, we also lost the mighty Chris Boucher, didn't we?
Yeah.
Who was the last surviving Doctor Who writer from before the 1980s? Which is quite that was quite a shock when you think about that, isn't it? It's,
yeah, I looked on Wikipedia earlier down all the seasons just to double check that stacks. It doesn't quite feel right, but I think it doesn't feel right because with all the Blu-ray releases that are coming out and the all the DVDs and everything, it feels as though there's quite a lot of people who are still with us, but actually in the last sort of 10 to 15 years, many of them have left this mortal coil. And it's just insane to think, I think, yeah, it's from season 18 we have writers who are still with us, which is just insane. For 17 years of Doctor Who, there's no one who's with us anymore now that Chris Boucher's gone. And I think, if I may, I think he was probably one of the best Doctor Who writers, actually. I wouldn't say he has a 100% success rate with his stories, but it's pretty close. He was a really, really good writer. And I know, obviously, He was the Blake Seven showrunner, wasn't he? From
yeah,
was it Series B onwards, or
script editor.
Yeah,
for all four seasons.
Yeah, I couldn't quite believe that statistic. That's mad. These people always seem like they're going to be with us forever.
But yes, you don't tend to think of them, do you? Possibly because not only did he only write three stories, but they were all squashed together, weren't they?
Mm-hmm.
In a single Doctor Companion era that only lasted about 18 months. So we're going to spend the rest of this podcast talking a bit about Chris's career, and then we're going to do a review of one of his stories. Ooh, you'll never guess which, listeners. Yeah, I thought it was interesting that he was already a sci-fi fan, particularly of American pulp magazines like Amazing Stories and Astounding Science Fiction. Because you tend to get people, don't you, who, as much as they may say, as they may be good at it, they will profess, I never understood science fiction, that sort of thing. Started by submitting jokes to TV shows like Dave Allen and That's Life. Dave Allen and That's Life, they probably did a 20-minute segment on cancer, and then after Esther Ranson had looked serious for a few seconds, she'd say, "Here's a carrot that someone sent in that looks like a cock." and then he moved on to his first work in TV sci-fi, which was with
sorry,
Doctor
Dog. Doc, that's
sorry, go on.
Doc, that's a picture of Michael Grade.
it was with Doctor Who, where he wrote three stories in 1977 for the Fourth Doctor Leela era, which was, of course, The Face of Evil, The Robots of Death, and Image of the Fendal. Went on to script edit all four seasons of Blake Seven, of which he wrote not only nine of the episodes, but probably nine of the very best episodes of the run of Blake Seven. May explain why he never ended up script editing Doctor Who.
Well, yeah, it seems as though he sort of missed the boat, because by the time that Blake Seven was over, obviously John Nathan Turner was there, and it was at a point where he was really reluctant to use people who had already worked on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyone with talent.
Well.
Oh.
If I could get my hands on that Doc Whom.
Possibly it happened because, I mean, he says in a very good interview in DWM 261 that because Bob Holmes was still script editing Doctor Who at the time, he was offered the Blake Seven script editing job by Terry Nation, he didn't want it, and so he recommended Chris Boucher. So by the time Bob Holmes had retired from script editing Doctor Who, Chris Boucher was sort of full throttle doing Blake Seven. So I don't know to what extent he was a protege of Bob Holmes. I think you've heard Philip Hinchcliffe say that Bob Holmes found Chris and had been encouraging him for a while, but I think what he actually did was he submitted a very, very early draft of Face of Evil to the BBC, and that's how they came across him, I think. But as Philip Hinchcliffe say, Bob didn't tinker much with the script. He just was pleased to have found a fellow traveller who had a crisp and slightly ironic edge to his writing. Sardonic, which we all liked.
Oh, as Chris described himself, smart-ass.
Post Blake Seven, he went on to script edit the likes of Shoestring, Juliet Bravo, and Bergerac, where he once again encountered Louise Jameson. Wrote for The Bill, ended up creating his own series of Star Cops, which I must say I don't think I've ever seen.
No, neither have I, actually.
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it, I'm afraid.
I've heard the theme tune.
You've heard more than me.
I understand it's only lasted for about nine episodes and it's become a super cult or something, but I don't think I've ever seen it myself. Wrote a few Doctor Who novels for BBC Books. I did a few audio dramas around the Caldor City meme. Any thoughts?
It's funny, isn't it? Because he was script editing on Blake Seven. There's still this sense that that's where some of his best work has come, because although it's hard to tell, it's hard to know exactly which lines are his, isn't it, on some of those. But Blake Seven has some of the sharpest and funniest little one-liners in it.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
to grace a TV sci-fi series. It's just wonderful. And I guess a lot of that, it feels like a lot of that was down to Chris Boucher, doesn't it? Certainly, I think he worked with Paul Darrow on stuff like that, didn't he?
Mm.
I think when he got scripts in, he tried to tailor them to the actors a bit more, didn't he? And certainly gave Darrow some gorgeous lines. The thing is, he gave all the characters wonderful dialogue. And I'm presuming much of it comes from him because it feels like it's kind of cut from the same cloth, doesn't it?
Hmm. I'm just looking through the list of Blake's 7 episodes now to see which ones he wrote. I'm just trying to see if there's any that I thought were particularly good. Shadow.
Shadow's the drugs one. Weapon, which is the... so that's Imi Pak. With the... As may become... Ooh, dropping hints now. As may become more appropriate for later on in the podcast with Scott Frederickson.
Ah, yes, of course.
I'm not sure I've seen most of his episodes because I didn't get past the first couple of episodes of Series C.
Ah, well, he did Trial, which is where Travis goes on trial and Blake goes and hides on a living planet for a bit. And then the last one you may have seen was Star One.
Star One.
Brilliant. Mm. One. And then I think they only did after that City at the Edge of the World.
Haven't seen that yet.
Which is the Colin Baker one. Rumours of Death, which, oh, that's extraordinary, that one.
Yeah, those are both really good couple of episodes.
Have You Murdered Your Way to an Underground War? Death Watch, which is the Tarrant meets his brother, isn't it? Rescue, which one was Rescue?
What was that hit by Echo and the Bunnymen?
Yes, in the final one. He only had time to do two. And Bob Holmes, Terry Nation, who had always recommended that if you're going to do any in a series, always do the very first of the series and the very last, because even if they cut down the series, they can't avoid showing those two. So he did Rescue, which was the first one after they found Scorpio, and then Blake, which was the notorious final episode of the whole lot.
All right. Yes, yes, indeed. No spoilers.
Yes, well, I almost said spoiler about mentioning Scorpio. I shall let Hayden just... that was bleak. I, for the episode before that, which was the end of the third series, I actually cried at the end of that one.
Oh. Wow.
I don't mean in the last few days. I mean when I was little.
See, I cried at how bleak series one was.
Oh, you snowflakes.
I just thought Blake was just such a wet blanket.
Yeah, but I'm so embarrassed that when I was a kid, I used to think, Blake, well, he's obviously the lead and he's in charge. He's who I'd want to be. And I don't like that Avon because he's not doing as he's told. I was such a little nerdy prefect type.
Oh, but Mark, don't ever feel embarrassed about that because that's your great value to the podcast. You're the nice one. If we ever lost you, it'd be very distressing. But even worse, we'd lose so many of our listener demographics.
Yeah.
Apple-cheeked grannies. Women with a strong maternal streak. Taxi drivers. All the Adric fans. And we'd be left with just bitter and angry men in the 30s to 50s range.
Ouch.
So Mark's great role models in his youth were Adric and Blake.
Something tells me we wouldn't have got on when we were younger, Mark.
Oh, God.
Oh, but that's always been Mark's problem, isn't he? Mark's just nice. That's his problem. That's why he supports Blake. Whereas Hayden and I, we're rotten, aren't we, to the core? That's why we like Avon.
He said that Blake 7 was the happiest time of his working life, didn't he, I think?
Yeah.
Which is ironic, considering how bleak the series is, but there we go.
Pipe down.
He must have been on Valium or Prozac, or playing with a box of kittens between scenes just to boost his mood.
I think I'm going to have to start a rewatch once now that I've started unpacking some of my stuff from storage, once I get my Blake 7 DVDs out, I shall treat myself to a rewatch, I think.
I suggested it to him.
You suggested it to him?
That's very keen of you.
Why didn't you suggest it to us?
Because I knew how you'd react.
Auron may be different, Callie, but on Earth it is considered ill-mannered to kill your friends while committing suicide.
It's getting worse for him, isn't it?
Guilt does that.
What would you know about guilt?
Only what I've read.
He really cares about us, doesn't he?
You swallowed that?
You think he was faking it?
Everything but the self-pity. That was real enough.
Is that it? Have you finally lost your nerve? Have you murdered your way to the wall of an underground room?
It's an old wall, Avon. It waits. I hope you don't die before you reach it.
Going back to his involvement with Doctor Who, the thing that failed to register with me was that he was the writer who created Leela.
Yes, yeah.
Mm. And mentioned in that Doctor Who magazine article, was it
261,
sorry. He based part of Leela on Leila Khalid, who was a Palestinian terrorist, who also had a song written about her by Julian Copen, and The Teardrop Explodes, which was my introduction into who Leila Khalid was. So I found it very interesting.
Which song was that?
It's called Just Like Leila Khalid Said. It's on the Wilder album.
Just like Leila Khalid says, sounds a bit like looking through Gary Gilmore's eyes, doesn't it?
Just like Leila Khalid said. Yeah, it's a good story, actually.
Looking through Gary Gilmore's eyes. Leila Khalid. Hang on, Khalid? Isn't that an anagram of...
Because I always thought that it was the Philip Hinchcliffe creation of... like the My Fair Ladies and like the Pygmalion kind of comparison between the Doctor and Leela. And so to see that she was based off Leila Khalid was interesting, let's just say the least. But
I wonder if the reason why we don't remember him for creating Leela is, I think he initially wrote her as a character, didn't he? And only having seen her. We like that, right? Robots of Death for us, and let's... I don't know if they could have said, oh, let's continue with Leela, because surely they could only say that if they liked Louise, couldn't they? And, and by the time Louise had finished acting all four episodes of Face of Evil, you would have thought that they must have already written The Robots of Death, wasn't they? So I don't know, actually.
Wasn't The Robots of Death written first, wasn't it?
No. Face of Evil was written first.
Oh, it was Face of Evil first. Okay.
Yeah. So Robots of Death would have been... because that had Pamela Salem in it, didn't it? So it was a similar...
Yes.
Similar situation to the one they had with Ace and Ray, where they kind of had these two characters in two stories next to each other, and they weren't sure which character they were going to keep on.
Oh, that's right, of course, yeah.
You see, listener, Mark is still smarting that they chose not to go with the motorcycle-riding Welsh lady. Oh,
lovely Ray.
It doesn't Ray, it pours, doesn't it, Mark?
Oh, I'm crying because that's terrible.
It's not one of my best.
He said something interesting about Bob Holmes, which was Chris Boucher, which was, again, in that DWM 261 interview, Bob was the weight in the Doctor Who office. The thing about the series then is that it was the learning slopes for producers as well. And what they really needed was an impressive and skilled script editor, someone who basically backed up everybody else. That was Bob. Producers tend to be ambitious people who want to move on. But it's been my experience that script editors, as with writers, like the series they're working on. Writers and editors are sometimes the only people you can rely on to be concerned with the crucial elements. I thought it was interesting that he used to hate people changing his lines. Yes, you said about his work on Blake 7, you'd learn which particular actors didn't deliver their lines as written. because they thought they knew better. And so you'd give them fewer lines, stop them doing it. It wasn't a revenge thing. It was protection of your own work. Maybe that was Gannu who used to do that. It certainly wasn't Avon or Villa. I think he makes it clear that he wasn't referring to them. Which is interesting, because Scott Fredericks said at one point, working with Tom was an education. The way he delivers lines, it's so beautiful. The rhythm of his speech is wonderful. And he subtly adjusted a few speeches so they just tripped off the tongue. A great actor. So if Tom was constantly adjusting his lines, you'd have thought that Chris Boucher would have lots of catchy things to say about him, wouldn't he? Although,
Well, he does, doesn't he?
Well, the only problem he seems to have is that during the read-through of one of them, was it Tom just kept taking the piss out of his script? And it really upset him.
Image of the Fendal.
Yeah. Tom was a monster. He was physically big, had a big personality and a big ego. And for a writer's point of view, he was a pain in the butt. I went to a read-through of one of my scripts when Tom was in full flow. George Spenton Foster, who's not one of my favourite directors. I wonder if this is why Chris Boucher very rarely does interviews. It's not that he's shy, as they seem to say, he keeps his slagging people off.
It makes Eric Saywood seem quite timid, doesn't he, really, in comparison?
George Spenton Foster, who's not one of my favourite directors, had done what he always did and taken the cast out to lunch and got them all drunk. So when I turned up at the read-through, I was the only sober one there, and Tom was sending up my script something rotten. I hadn't been to many read-throughs back then, and I must say I was deeply embarrassed, and at that point I really hated him. I went back to my office and kicked a couple of filing cabinets. I also remember expressing at the time a great desire to see the bastard die in a cellar full of rats.
Oh, well, do you know what? Chris Boucher is not going to have his contract renewed by Amazon Prime now, is he?
I got over it eventually, and I liked Tom when we met afterwards.
This seems a very common thread with people who worked with him at the time, though, wasn't it? That they all found him quite unbearable to work with.
Yes, yeah.
I think even John Nathan Turner didn't get on with him when they worked on the show. But then obviously they were good drinking buddies afterwards, so...
I don't know that I ever worked for anybody twice, you know. In fact, when I look back over my life, I don't think I've ever done anything with anybody twice. I've never been invited twice to anybody's house. Never worked twice for a director. Never been twice in a theatre.
You can pick up on it, can't you, actually, sometimes? It's one of those things where you kind of don't want to know behind the scenes. It kind of spoils it for you. I know we said before about how, you know, Matthew Waterhouse was sort of looked down upon by Tom and Lala, and how then Pete Davidson came in. It's like, you kind of don't want to know that. You kind of want to think that everyone got on and everyone was great, and it sort of spoils your perception of them in a way, which is a shame. But yeah, Tom Baker...
That's why I won't listen to the commentaries from Lala's era on the DVDs, because you know why she and Tom aren't in the same... or they do that thing where Toby Haydock will say, this is episode 2, and Tom isn't with us now, but Lala has joined us.
Oh. Was it Tom once said about their union? He said, and we were happier for a bit.
Yeah. I mean, I saw an interview with Lala Ward in the 90s, and she was saying, but when you were with Tom, it was Tom time. She said, but I have to say, I loved Tom time. It was great fun. I really enjoyed it. I remember reading that in an interview and thinking, well, that's very odd. That's not quite the impression I get.
Yeah, but what does she specifically mean as Tom time, Mark?
Oh, okay. Moving on.
So, we thought we would take a look at... mainly because we've already done Robots of Death. We take a look at Image of the Fendal as our tribute to Chris Boucher. Third story of season 15, broadcast towards the end of 1977. First of all, great title. Maybe only because it's not the insert noun here of the insert noun here. But I just love the way it trips off the tongue, Image of the Fendal.
Mm.
Directed, as we've said, by George Spenton Foster, who also directed the Rebus operation, and who all the actors seem to have only nice things to say about. I can't remember whether I saw it on first broadcast, or whether I only saw it after, when was it, 1970? What was I doing in 1977? No, I must have done. Although I never saw, for some reason, I never saw The Invisible Enemy until, you know, home video days. But I must have done, because I remember seeing Face of Evil. Any thoughts on Image of the Fendar?
Well, it's got a special place in my sort of history with the show, because it was the first Target novel I ever bought.
Ah!
I remember getting it because on that one occasion I went to the Bookworm in Clacton. It was the first book I picked up that had an actual image of the Doctor on the front. And this weird, like, snake kind of like creature with, like, ood tentacles coming out of its mouth. Of course, I didn't know what an ood was yet, but anyway, that was about 10 years in the future. But I distinctly remember picking up this very thin book with Tom Baker on the front, the Fendaline on the front, and that sort of dark blue hue behind it. And guess what? I never read it. Even though it was my first Target novel, I never read it. Because on my next trip, I got Doctor Who and the Cybermen, and that was the first one I ever read. So that was... But yeah, so it was the first one I bought, but I never read it. And I don't have it anymore now. I must have been a part of a charity shop binge about 10, 15 years ago. No, longer ago than that. Anyway.
Did your granddad have a good day at the races that day?
I don't know. I only came home with one book, so I presume not. And they're only selling them for like 50p, so it must have been quite a thin day in Ladbrokes? Yeah, it was a Ladbrokes, yeah, across the road from it. But anyway, and I didn't actually see this story until the DVD came out. Even though I knew what the Fendalines looked like, it was a bit of an unknown quantity, but remember the first thing that I was struck by was how good the supporting cast was. The fact that Cassandra's dad from Only Fools and Horses was in it with this weird sort of like Eastern European accent, and Wanda Ventham was in it as well, who was also Cassandra's mum in Only Fools and Horses. So
I
saw this, I thought, oh, it's Cassandra's parents in the same Doctor Who story. So yes, it's very, very odd, and I got confused with Edward Arthur's Colby. I actually thought it was the same. I thought it was Michael Craze. I thought he looked quite similar to Michael Craze. So I thought Michael Craze was back playing as it was really bizarre. But the thing that struck me watching it this time was that I know it's got the elements because it's set in a priory, and it's the same priory as the one that they used as a location shoot for in Pyramids of Mars, isn't it? So you have sort of fairly sort of gothic qualities to it. But the thing that struck me watching it this time was that I had to kind of double check, because I remember thinking when I did my watch through of Doctor Who in order around the time of the 50th, this was probably the last good story for a little while. And I wondered if it had anything to do with Robert Holmes, because I knew that he'd stayed on a little bit longer than Philip Hinchcliffe had. And this was the last story that Philip Hinchcliffe commissioned, and it's also the last that Robert Holmes was the script editor on, fully. He did a bit of The Sunmakers as the next story with Anthony Reed.
Sorry to step in. It's not actually Bob Holmes's last one that he script edited, because apparently this is all Anthony Reed's script editing. But on the script, it was written down as Robert Holmes, Anthony Reed. And on the TV screen, for some reason, it just says Robert Holmes. But it's actually script edited by, according to the interview that comes with the DVD on the DVD extra.
Oh, right.
So, okay. So it's not even, Robert Holmes commissioned it and then he handed over to Anthony Reed.
Yeah. Which explains for the drop off in quality, but there you go.
And probably Robert Holmes wouldn't have script edited The Sunmakers because he wrote it, didn't he?
Yeah.
I did think that, because there was something, it was a BBC rule at the time, wasn't it? That's why when Barry Letts wrote Planet of the Spiders, The Demons, and The Green Death, it was in Robert Sloman's name, wasn't it, for those?
That's why Chris Boucher only wrote two stories for the final era of Blake 7, because the Equity was starting to put pressure on the BBC not to allow script editors to also write for their own.
Of course.
Because effectively they could commission themselves, couldn't they? That is a strange series, actually. Yeah, because some makers, of course, is Bob Holmes' vile, cowardly attack on the taxman, isn't it?
Oh! I loved some makers.
I must have told this story, mustn't I, that when I was in the old days, when I was in Customs and Excise, before they merged with the Inland Revenue, and we still had the old job titles. Because it was one of the oldest government departments, because the king has been levying taxes on wool and beer, etc., since time immemorial. That's why some of the posts still had vaguely medieval-sounding names. My boss's boss was known as the Collector.
Brilliant.
Well, there is another post vacant. Collector of Revenues for York.
Is it in your gift?
Effectively.
But that one must have been a strange series, because I remember watching Horror of Fangrock at the time. I didn't realise Invisible Enemy existed until I watched the Tom Baker years. I think I watched Image. I must have watched The Sun Makers, because I remember at school, in the weeks in between parts 1, 2, 3, and 4, we were going around teasing each other by saying things like, you're affluent or something. Underworld is another one I had no idea existed. But Invasion of Time, I did see. So I wonder what's happening on those days.
Probably for the best, isn't it, Doc?
September.
You were probably queuing to see Star Wars in 1977, weren't you? Mm-hmm. So maybe you missed most of the season because you were trying to get in the cinema.
That might have been it. I actually think, and this may be... I don't think this is an original thought, but I think that this might arguably be Tom Baker's weakest season.
Oh.
Season 15.
That's interesting.
Arguably. I'm not completely sponging season 17 off this.
I was biting my tongue. Yes! Season 17's not his least favourite.
I think season 17 still pips it for me, but yeah,
as being the worst. Because this does have Horror of Fangrock and this, but this is also the debut, I should say, as well, of Tom Baker's longest scarf.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yes, it is. Two scarves were knitted, and then Tom asked if it could be made longer, so they just knitted both scarves together for this story. So this is the debut of that scarf being really okay. Long.
I suppose the previous series, 14, was with Mandragora, Hand, Assassin, Face, Robots of Death, and Wang Chiang was possibly the last of what some of us outrageously tend to call that golden age. So, and I think it's possibly from then on, when Philip Hinchcliffe disappears, that you start getting crap like The Invisible Enemy and Underworld.
And The Invasion of Time.
I need to rewatch Invasion of Time, because last time I watched it, I quite enjoyed it, so...
Oh, it was not too bad, The Invasion of Time.
You would, Mark. You would. No, it's terrible. I can't stand it.
Oh, really?
I really do think, honestly, I think Fangrock and this story are the only ones that I would go and choose to watch again from season 15. But having said that, I think the quality of the script, it's not up there with The Robots of Death. But I do think it's a cracking script. I just think what it's trying to do, it's kind of been done before in the series. You know, you've got scientists in a priory. What are they doing in a priory? Well, that's... Why were they in the priory?
They didn't find
the skull, did they?
There's a time fissure in the woods next to it. That's why. The time fissure is where all these sonic energies or blah energies flowing through, and that's what draws the... So when the sonic generator thing's on, the time scanner's on, that's what draws the TARDIS down to there.
Okay.
And there's a time fissure in the woods. Although I think that's only mentioned later on, isn't it, the time fissure? Like, I don't think the Doctor mentions it when he lands or anything else, unless I somehow missed it.
Or maybe Bob Holmes was just a really big Mick Jagger fan.
Well, there is that. Yeah, I mean, because this does have similarities in that sense to Pyramids of Mars and also Evil of the Daleks as well. Scientists in a gothic priory. So.
And also, the Time Monster in a way, isn't it? Those scientists in that, which is really sort of like a manor house, buggering about with time. Tom Tit.
Mm. Yeah. So it kind of, yes, it kind of feels like this is ground that's been tread, not
trod.
This feels like ground that has been gone over in a not so recent way, really. And it's a little bit convoluted in places as well. Is it ever explained why Dr. Fendelman is called Fendalman, and that when you've got the Fendal and the Fendaline, and he's Fendelman? Like, is there an irony in that?
Yes. Like,
is it the bit when the Doctor sort of garbles when he meets him? He says something under his breath, and I kept rewinding it to see what he says, and I couldn't get it.
He says something like, "Oh, you must be Professor Fendelman. Is that really your name, Fendelman?"
Yes.
And then just goes straight on to...
Yeah, that's right.
Who's in charge around here?
I am.
Dr. Fendelman, I presume. Is that really your name, Fendelman? Now, listen, Fendelman, I wanted to do two things.
So he clearly recognises the word Fendel.
Yeah, when Fendelman tied up to the pillar just before he gets shot, he does say, he says to Stahl, I get it now, I get this, I understand. That's why I'm called Fendelman, because my family goes back generations. My family genes were earmarked to bring humanity to this point, and I'd be at that point as well. So that's why.
Right.
So he'd been like picked out. It was all part of the Fendal's plan.
How did I miss that? Because I was watching this, I thought, fairly intently, but clearly not. Did I fall asleep at some point? I'm not sure. Know.
It's similar in a way to his line in Genesis, where he briefly latches onto something but seems not to pursue it, though he obviously does.
Even you mutos know the difference between Thals and Khaleds.
K-A-L-E-D-S. Why, that's an anagram of... How interesting. Are you fit, Harry?
Yeah. You know what you said there about, going back slightly, about the scientists in the manor house?
Hmm.
It wasn't too long ago that we watched Nigel Neal's The Stone Tape.
Of course, yes.
Do you know what? Yes. 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 That's very...
And an awful lot of this, well, I mean, I think Chris Boucher himself admitted that he kind of cribbed the plot slightly from Quatermass and the Pit. But,
yes. God, yes, of course. Oh, my God. Yes.
Quatermass is one of my favourite B-movie sci-fi films.
Mm. I think this whole story reeks of Nigel Neal, but certainly the Stone Tape. There's real similar kind of vibe and atmosphere, isn't there? All those computers in like a manor house and things like that. Mm. And you know, it's very,
yes,
very similar. Yeah. You know, it's in the computers, or whatever it is that Duggan shouts.
In fact, if you do think about it, it's very Quatermass in the Pit, isn't it, the whole plot?
It really is. Now you've mentioned it, I can't escape the,
You know, an alien race. And doesn't he say... You know, he talks about the fifth planet breaking up. He says they probably took in Mars on the way to Earth, didn't he? And they've got stuff like, talk about Thetch Priory and Fetchborough.
Yes.
It's very like things like Hobbs Lane, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Old names for the devil.
Yeah.
Although he does say, doesn't he, if I'm honest, Image of the Fendal was heavily influenced by a Harry Harrison novel called Captive Universe, which I haven't seen, but I have bought... In the last few days. Harry Harrison. What is that? Sailor Steel Rat, isn't he?
Yes, yes. He is indeed.
It was in 2018.
Have you ever read Harry Harrison's Stainless Steel Rat books? I think you'd enjoy them,
no.
Hayden. I think you'd like them.
I'll give them a go, mate. I'm game for anything.
Try the first one if you like it. Read another.
Oh, is that how it works?
Yeah. Mark's like a pusher on the street, isn't he? Hey, little boy, you want to try some reading? A creature from my own mythology should have perished when the fifth planet broke up. Maybe that's the origin of throwing salt over your shoulder. Very sort of mythological and race memories, isn't it?
Mm.
It was nice that there was a little bit of like Time Lord mythology in there, I have to say. Like the bit when they do...
go to the fifth planet, they see that it's in a time loop, which means that any existence of it, it wouldn't be on record because it's in this time loop that the time lords put it. They must have been so scared that they put it in.
It was destroyed, and then they put the destroyed area where it was into a time loop, so that you couldn't go back in and go back to the planet. So the moment where the planet ceased existing is all that's there for past, present, future.
Got it.
What I liked about that as well was when he said the Time Lords had done that, he then goes, they're not supposed to do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I was about to say. Because nowadays, in the sort of RTD, Stephen Moffat era, where we're, and possibly Chris Chibnall era, we're all supposed to hate Time Lords, it would be, oh, the Time Lords did a sort of illegal time loop. I must destroy every single one of them and turn them into Cybermen.
This is clearly at the point where Louise Jameson and Tom Baker are getting on as well, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Right
now.
Yes, I think so. Great relationship.
Because they have some good chemistry in this story. By the moment when she, I was about to say the moment she yanks him off. The moment when she takes him.
They had
a great relationship on this.
Wow.
The moment when the power of the skull, it's overpowering him and they sort of fall to the ground, don't they?
Yes.
So are you all right at the same time?
So that synchronization that they've clearly worked on really hard, because that is difficult to do, like to get that timing right. They're absolutely spot on, aren't they?
So
you can't do that kind of scene with someone and get the line that good.
Yes.
No, you can't. Because this is the first story after K-9 has joined as well, hasn't it? K-9 doesn't really play a part. He's told he's got like corrosive circuits, so he's going to need fixing. And I think that kind of allows that duo to breathe a little, not having K-9 there just yet. Cause is the Sunmakers his first proper story? I'm trying to remember now. I think it is, isn't it, with K-9?
Yes, because he's going down all those corridors, isn't he, zapping people.
Being a part of the action. Yeah, so this is kind of like the last time we actually get that, just the duo of Doctor and female companion for a little while, isn't it, actually for quite some time before K-9 pokes his protruding nose into everything. I thought some of their dialogue really zinged. Like you were saying earlier about that sardonic edge that Chris Boucher seems to have. He seems to sort of channel it all into Colby in this story, I find.
Sorry, I'm just, that's tickled me, thinking about Colby, because there's that. If there could have been one actor who'd like to have seen reading Colby's lines, it would have been Matt Berry. Because there's that when the doctor's telling Colby about, it's an embryo Fendaline, and he goes,
they look like embryo Fendaline to me.
Embryo what?
Embryo Fendaline.
A creature from mythology. Do you know, I can't do the thing now. Do you know what you're talking about? But that whole thing could have been delivered by Matt Berry. So
I was wondering who Matt Berry was.
Can I then send you the clip of Matt Berry saying the words New York City after that? New York City.
You really are the most devious bastard in New York City.
Toast of London?
Oh, I've never seen that.
What We Do in the Shadows as well, and and Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. And...
I was thinking, what is Mark talking about? The guy from Heartbeat.
Sorry, I interrupted you, Hayden. What were you saying?
Doesn't matter now. I'm just thinking of Matt Berry being in Image of the Fendal.
It's interesting what you say about some great lines, but because Chris Boucher was writing it and Bob Holmes was script editing it,
It's not, though, is he? It's Anthony Reed.
Anthony Reed, yeah.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, of course, isn't it? Because I was thinking when Colby says to the Tylers, don't threaten me, you Swede-bashing cretin. I thought, that's very on a par with you ham-fisted bun vendor, isn't it? Which is a Bob Holmes line.
Took me a while to realise that Geoffrey Hinsliffe, who plays Jack Tyler, he was in Nightmare of Eden, wasn't he? As playing one of the gay policemen from Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Costume.
Yeah, from a Frankie Goes to Hollywood video.
I think what you mean, Hayden, is one of the really hard customs officers.
Yeah. Well, he may have been, but...
What I actually meant was he was one of the very happy police officers in...
In my teens, he was Don Brennan in Curry.
Well, you see, this is what I thought. I have an enduring memory of him blowing up in a car in Coronation Street.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. I think he blew up, from what I remember. I think he was in a car accident and his car exploded.
Oh, here we go. In October 1997, Don tried one last time to kill Mike, this time in Mike's factory.
Don tied him up, but Angie Freeman whacked Don over the head with a big shoe. Oh, Corey, he never ceased to amaze me. And Don reappeared in the street in Alma's MG Midget Roadster, which he had stolen, and saw Mike crossing the street by the cabin. He drove straight at Mike and tried to run him over, but Mike dived out of the way just in time. Don lost control of the car and crashed into the viaduct. Mike escaped unharmed, but Don was killed when the car exploded in a fireball on impact, burning him to death. The resulting stain was evident for many years on the viaduct.
Oh, wow. Know that?
So the stain of Don Brennan was on the viaduct for many years. Wow.
So was he in the car when it crashed, or was he...
No, he was driving the car, and he was in the car when it exploded. And then it took ages to take the stain of exploded Don off the side of the viaduct in Coronation Street.
It just couldn't be bothered to paint over it, and he just left it.
Oh, we really need to consult Matt on this, don't we?
Yeah, we do. Oh, well. We do.
Talking about those funny lines as well, a very Chris Barrett line as well. You must have been sent by Providence. I was sent by the council to cut the hedges.
Yeah.
Your council should choose its warriors more carefully. There is some great stuff. You've both escaped from somewhere, haven't you? Frequently.
Yeah.
You must have been sent by Providence.
No, I was sent by the council. Cut the verges.
Your council should choose its warriors more carefully. A child of the 17 could have taken you.
Escaped from somewhere, didn't she? If you're a doctor, you shouldn't let her wander around loose. You could do someone a damage.
He was not hunting us?
No. Would you like a jelly bean, Ian?
You both escaped from somewhere, haven't you?
Frequently.
Yeah, I'm always banging on about how in things like Brain of Morbius, Tom effortlessly manages to trot out meaningless techno babble as if it's conversation. Mm. Does it here again?
Yes.
He talks about...
Beautiful.
Beautiful?
Yes, sodium chloride. Obviously affects the conductivity, ruins the overall electrical balance and prevents control of localised disruption of the osmotic pressures.
Salt kills it.
I just said that. Probably the origin of throwing it over your shoulder. Come on. What happened was this. The energy amassed by Defendal was stored in the skull and dissipated slowly as a biological transmutation field. Hmm? Now, any appropriate life form that came within the field was altered so that it ultimately evolved into something suitable for Defendal to use.
He does it without waving his hands around or panting as well, doesn't he? Whilst talking to people as if they're five.
Yes, yeah. Not doing his wood chopping motions.
I was just going to say, he does mumble, though. He sort of talks a little bit under his breath and very, very quickly. And it's just like I missed that whole bit about Fendelman. That comment about Fendelman's name. I mean, that's kind of the classic series equivalent of the Murray Gold score. You know, I can't quite hear the dialogue. It's when Tom Baker mumbles under his breath, you know.
I was watching for the podcast with the subtitles on, though, so otherwise I'd never pick up lines like, I accept without reservation the results of your excellent potassium argon test.
Yes.
I mean, considering I'm the only member of the Dilly Dun podcast who wears hearing aids, maybe I should as well. Then I wouldn't. Then these things wouldn't pass me by, you know.
I'm getting increasingly deaf in my left ear, so I'll be joining you soon. I'm a technician, not a human paleontologist, damn it. It's another line. Well, they don't say damn it, but I wish they had.
That's a very Dr. McCoy from Star Trek, isn't it? That's kind of that.
Yeah. Yes, doctor, indeed. I wonder if that was like a little nod to that. It felt like
And if Bob Holmes wasn't involved in script editing this, then Chris Boucher certainly is, I think, in some way inspired by him, because Mrs. Tyler and Jack have got to be what's quite close to a Holmesian double act, haven't they?
I have to admit, actually, the way that Thea is sort of this not quite a damn... Well, she is kind of a damsel in distress, isn't she? But she's one of only two women in this story. And I did think to myself, oh, yeah, the women are really underrepresented in this story. But then I actually kind of think, you know, the Martha Tyler character actually kind of makes up for that in a sense, because she's quite a...
Oh, she steals every scene, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does. Yeah. And I like the way that Tom Baker, well, the Doctor, I should say, interacts with her. It's like, it reminds me of the Amelia Rumford.
Yes, yeah.
Interactions that he has in The Stones of Blood, you know, where he's very, you can tell he sort of dotes on them a little bit.
Tom likes an elder lady actress, though, doesn't he? He gets on with them. He seems to respect them and enjoy working with them.
Never trust a man as wears a hat.
Still no sign of him. Sundown, he said.
I didn't reckon he'd be reliable. Never trust a man as wears a hat.
Well, Granddad always wore one.
And a wicked old devil he were, too.
Well, I wear one.
But I give it to him. That's different.
And Muckle, yeah. Yeah, I like that line.
Little things like, sooner or later... Later or sooner, he'll learn. I thought, what? I mean, it's nothing, is it? All you're doing is transposing a famous phrase, but it's just lovely little bits like that. Mm.
Oh, and another character that made me laugh was when Leela's talking to Jack Tyler, and she's reassuring him, telling him how good the Doctor is. And the last word is in his gentleness. And it cuts to Tom locked in the cupboard, the Doctor locked in the cupboard, angrily kicking the box across the floor. It's great.
And we never found who let him out of that cupboard, did we?
No.
Wasn't it the sonic screwdriver? Because he was trying to use the sonic to get out, wasn't he?
No, it didn't work at all, which is why he threw it across the room. So we've got Dennis Lill. Who was Mark, of course, one of the, he was Charles Vaughan in Survivors.
Yes.
Doesn't he effectively almost take over towards the latter seasons of Survivors?
Yes, we were watching... Have you seen it before then, Survivors?
No, I just read it somewhere.
Yeah, we started watching it during lockdown, didn't we?
Hmm. It got too depressing, didn't it?
Yeah, it was like, this isn't really the TV show for us to watch for a bit of entertainment during lockdown. I didn't realise for ages those were the same actor. They're only about a year or two apart as well, aren't they, the performances?
Yeah.
Because he looks so much older in Image of the Fendal.
Mm.
To me, he looks almost like a completely different person. I didn't realise it was the guy from Survivors for ages. Yeah, he's the guy who's running the little... he's running the sex farm, isn't he, in the first series.
Oh, right.
It's amazing the stuff he turns up in, Dennis Lill, because he's also in Blackadder the Third.
I know.
As Sir Talbot Buxomly, who dies instantly as soon as he sits down when he's...
promised to vote for the prince, yeah.
Getting it, they're roping him in to vote for... Yeah, vote for the prince. And then he's also the leader of the orphanage in Blackadder's Christmas Carol as well.
Oh, right.
And he's also the rogue simulant in one of the best episodes of Red Dwarf as well, called Gummon of the Apocalypse, which you need to check out. That's really good. But he's also in a blink and you'll miss it scene in the 1989 film Batman.
Really?
He plays Bob the cartoonist, which is supposed to be a reference back to Bob Kane, who is the guy who goes up to Knox with the picture of the bat. He's like, hey, is this your guy? Dennis Lill just turns up in almost everything I watched in the 90s. Dennis Lill was there. It's incredible. He was also in Evita as well. He's in Evita. He plays the president in Evita, the Madonna.
He was the squire in The Awakening, wasn't he?
Yes.
Sir George, wasn't he?
Yeah, I completely forgot about that. Of course he was.
Edward Arthur, who played Colby, was... Tom Baker says in the Tom Baker years that he was a juvenile with him.
That was Edward Arthur there against the post, with whom I, as a, almost a juvenile, was in Great Expectations with Colchester, was it? Somewhere in Essex, anyway, we were juveniles together, and he was playing Pip, the grown-up Pip. And I had to come in a rush and play Compeyson, who gets stabbed at the end of the second act. And I came in and wrote the lines on my hands, you know, because Compeyson looks very worried, so he was able to do that a lot and read the lines that he was supposed to be saying. Actors get up to all these sort of tricks. And there was no time to rehearse. It may have been Colchester rep. And Eddie reminded me of that, that when I came in to be killed, that they did the business with the knife, and I held the knife like that and made lots of gurgling noises, and then realized that I didn't know where to die. There was not enough room for me to die. And the actors, I heard no one can be more vicious than actors in Weekly Rep saying, for Christ's sake, lie down and die. And I didn't know where to die. And Eddie Arthur pointed at the place, and I reminded him how kind he was. I can't remember very much about that story, except finding Wanda Ventham terribly desirable, even at rehearsal at the read-through. But the more gold paint they put on her, the more desirable she became. And I was quite disturbed for hours afterwards, yes. The boy with the gran is now very famous in Coronation Street. He's so famous that his name eludes me. He wasn't famous then, of course.
Height of Eddie Arthur's career was as he was a police inspector in Secret Army. Scott Fredericks was in Day of the Daleks, of course.
Mm-hmm.
As one of the gorillas, and as we've said in Blake 7, Daphne Hurd playing Mrs. Tyler was the Czechoslovakian mother in To the Manor Born. Geoffrey Hinchcliffe, as we've said, was in Corrie and Nightmare. And Wanda Ventham, of course, was... Well, she was in The Faceless Ones.
Yeah.
I didn't remember. Mm. Mind you, half of it's gone, isn't it? And she's also Smaug's mother.
Huh? What?
She was Benedict Cumberbatch's mother, wasn't she?
Oh, sorry, I was going to say, I don't remember Smaug having a mum. Something else that Scott Fredericks was in, he was in the Dad's Army film as a Nancy.
Oh, yeah, I can see him being a Nazi.
A Nazi? This is a Nancy. So, nothing... I don't think it stands out in the way, say, like Robots of Death would. As something, oh, this is a new thing in Doctor Who, isn't it? But, like we're saying, the scientists in a country house messing around with time and that is hardly new. But I think it works very well.
I think it works brilliantly. It's one that I definitely have memories of from broadcast, even though I would have only been roughly around about six. But I remember the feeling of dread. I've got some vague memories of... And I think it's from the first episode, that first episode one cliffhanger, of Tom still standing there and, like, not being able to move. And you can hear that slithering noise.
Mm. Mm.
And it's quite tense. It's very horrific. I mean, really, the horror and the tense atmosphere, the haunting atmosphere, I think it's fairly well maintained until the end of part three, when the Fendal actually appears, or to the Fendaline. Because I think that's a great creation, those big slithering monsters. And I think in photos, they look amazing. In pictures, you know, illustrated on books and things, they look great. And it's just when they're moving, when you actually see one on screen moving, it kills it, unfortunately. Because I do think it's a good design. It's just, I think there's a lot of Doctor Who creatures who are like that, isn't there? That look great in photographs. Once you actually see them on the screen moving, don't know, it's just, I know the cast fell about laughing for 15 minutes when it first appeared, and so they had to take a break. But otherwise, I think it's a really good, scary, atmospheric thing. And I think a lot of that's also down to the sound design or the sound effects, like the whining noise that comes from the skull, the humming, and the, like they say, the sound of the Fendaline moving, and also... The soundtrack itself, I think, is really great. There's that bit where, in the first scene, with first time you see Martha Tyler, the housekeeper in there, there's that which Doc referred to earlier, where she says, sooner or later or sooner. And there's a lovely little bit of spooky, haunting, witchy music just going on underneath it, just as she says that. And it's lovely. And I think the sound on this is really good.
Don't mind him, my lovelies. Sooner or later, he'll be sorry. Later or sooner, he'll regret. Well, I'll be going now, Professor. You can tell Dr. Fendelman I'll come back when the others is gone. I don't know what the likes of he. There isn't a dog born as it attack me, boy. They got more sense than most people.
I think it's a really good story, and I just think it's possibly let down by the realisation, like I said, or the movement of the creatures. And I do wonder why it's not more highly regarded. I'm often surprised by how low it is in polls, because I think it's fairly good. It's you know, that, like you said, Hayden, that's a great supporting cast. Even though Edward Arthur is a bit, it's got a strange delivery, I really enjoy it.
There was just one other thing I forgot to say going through the production notes, was that Chris Boucher was inspired in this story by the work of a man who would like excavate human remains, an archaeologist called Louis Leakey.
Yes.
And so Chris Boucher named Colby's dog in the story Leakey. But then he later realised that people would miss the reference and assume the name came because, quote, he pissed all over everything.
Yes. That's literally what I thought when I heard it.
But then Terence Dix's subsequent novelisation of the serial, in fact, gives both reasons for the name. So,
good old Terence there, putting in a joke about a piss joke everywhere.
What colour was the piss, Uncle Terence?
The piss has got to be green.
In the DWM Top 200 in 1909, it only came 73rd.
But there's an awful lot, especially for this era, that I would put in front. It's such a strong era. Like, if this had been a Colin Baker story, then it'd be head and shoulders the best one out of that era. You know, and possibly a Peter Davison one, it would be really, really high up in that too. I think it's just, it's kind of lost in... You've got the advent of the season after this being the Key to Time series, and then you've got, you know, City of Death to come as well, and then, you know, you've got some people who are fans of season 18, others who aren't, but... You can't deny that the 3 years that preceded this were incredibly strong. You know, there's possibly like one or two dud stories in the previous 15 stories before this, you know, or 17 or whatever it was, you know. I don't mind The Invisible Enemy, actually, as well. It's a bit silly, isn't it, in places, but I just think that Fendahl kind of gets swallowed up by all of it surrounding it, but it's still a great story. I think it's Boucher's second best script, I think, for me. I think all three of his stories are really good.
Yeah.
But it pips The Face of Evil for me to be runner-up to, you know, undoubtedly Robots of Death being his best story. It's the lines are witty, it's got an interesting premise. It does lack originality for this point in Who history, though, I think. And actually, there's shards of this which I think are then carried through to Hyde in the Matt Smith era too, I find, although that's, again, the Stone Tape influence, isn't it? Neil Cross said about when he wrote Hyde. I mean, feels like we're going to give a score in a minute, so I don't know whether to give mine first and then...
Or to stop and let you two wrap up first. But let's wrap up first. I don't know what Dr. Scott left to say.
Go for it.
I've got nout. Nout at all.
Okay. Do you know what? It's an odd point. At this point in 1977, there was a TV show. Now, I'm wondering if Image of the Fendahl may have been influenced by Mark Bolan, because there's...
Oh, really?
One scene. You know the scene where Thea becomes the Fendahl? She's laid out on the pentagram, and she slowly, rigidly rises up, which is like very reminiscent one of Nosferatu. But also, I was watching, I think it was an episode of Supersonic from possibly early 77.
Is it Dreamy Lady?
He's on a star.
Yes, it's Dreamy Lady.
Yes, you know.
Yeah, when he comes up like that, yeah.
It sticks briefly for just a moment and then carries on moving and propels him forward.
Yeah,
and it's at the time when Mark Bolan sadly was in a bit of decline. Very similar, isn't it? Because Pentagram's star shape. And he's literally laid flat on the star shape, and same thing, it rises slowly, and up he comes with the star, and it just jams slightly, and then pings him off.
I'll find this, and I'll send it. It was the stagehands. He'd annoyed them earlier on during the run-through, so that's what they chucked him off the back of it.
Is it Supersonic, is that right?
It might have been his program. It might have been his own program. I'm going to look it up. Hang on a minute.
You've got it. You only need to see the opening seconds.
Hang on, I've got it.
That's it. Yeah, this is it.
Hold on.
Find on the screen, will you, computer?
Oh.
Dreaming lady. I'm seeing T-Rex to see the number one tribute band next month. Yeah, taking my mum and her partner, let's have a look again.
He does a good job of staying on his feet, actually, to be fair.
Still waiting for it to go up.
Keep it light, will you, Mark? It's a family show.
On his final ever live appearance on TV.
It stops halfway up. Oh, close him off, bless.
On his final ever TV appearance, he was with David Bowie, and he fell off the stage. I've seen that as well. I've brought up on stuff like this. Good grief. But it's very reminiscent.
Yeah. God, to think that was the same year. I always think Doctor Who's later than things like Mark Boland, but of course it wasn't, was it?
Wow.
What a time to be alive, you jammy bastard.
I'm saying nothing.
As ever, listeners, links to all of this can be found in our show notes at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com.
Yeah, should we give it a score then?
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
Marks out of 10?
I'm going to give it an 8, actually. I do really like this. Where did this come, Doc, in our... Fourth Doctor retrospective.
I should have a look. I'm just opening it now. It came. I think how impressed the listeners will be when I edit out this long pause and seem to give you the answer immediately.
Yeah.
13th out of 40 odd. That's not too bad, actually.
No, that is pretty good, actually. Yeah, that's probably where I'd have it.
What, it came 13th?
Yeah.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, no, that's... Yeah. Shall I give it a score?
Yeah, what do you give it out of 10, Matt?
I would give it... I'd give it 8.5, because I think it's really good, but I think, as most people generally tend to say, and I would agree with them, it's not quite as good as Robots of Death. So I'd give it 8.5. I really enjoyed this. When I put it on this morning to rewatch the podcast, I felt a little shiver of joy. I thought, wow, I'm really looking forward to this. And it didn't disappoint. It was really good.
I think I'd give it an 8 as well. So, not too bad. So, Chris Boucher, probably more famous for the BBC's other totemic contribution to the sci-fi genre, Blake 7. But even if he'd only written Robots of Death, he would have been splendid for me. In fact, I rewatched Face of Evil in preparation for this. And that was better than I thought it would. I remember it being.
Mm.
As was Louise in it.
Mm.
And if for nothing else, he would be famous for having written the line, "The very powerful and the very stupid have one thing in common. They don't alter their views to fit the facts. They alter the facts to fit their views." Mm. Which has that end, which can be uncomfortable if you're one of the facts which needs changing. And, of course, you're a classic example of the inverse ratio between the size of the mouth and the size of the brain. Which apparently is what Matthew Waterhouse used to keep reciting at school. You do wonder how he came out alive, don't you?
Yeah, and see, that's the sort of stuff he carried on doing all the way through Blake 7 as well, wasn't it? It's just, you know.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
What, Matthew Waterhouse? When does he turn up in Blake 7?
I never knew that...
I should stick to action, Blake. That's what you're good at.
Was a direct quote from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Oh, really?
You just keep thinking, Butch. That's what you're good at.
Because apparently Paul Darrow and Chris Boucher had a great love of westerns. Right then. Shall we... Uncle Terence, have you come to say goodbye to us? Have you been having a good New Year?
Well, still sleeping off the hangover, Doc. Still sleeping it off. I've been in quarantine for a little while as well, because I was looking after Chris Boucher's dog, Leaky, and he peed all over me on Christmas Day, and the pee was all green. So I've been in quarantine, and I've been sleeping off the hangover, so hopefully he'll be better.
If they've got this famous dog in it, is that why they call it Fetch Prairie? Uncle Terrence, we've got to get rid of a couple of dead bodies that have been killed by the Fendelina, which we've performed illegal autopsies on. Have you any ideas?
Yes, just wait for them to decompose unnaturally quickly, as Dennis Little says in the story. Otherwise, just dump them in a river. No, don't dump bodies in a river.
Uncle Terrence, we have embryo Fendelene all over Wanda Ventham's unconscious body.
Stand back, fellas, I'm going in.
Good night.
Good night, everyone.
I think we should leave it at that. Just say goodbye.
Goodbye.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dun Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydunpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and stitcher.com at diddlydun, on Twitter at diddly_dun, or email us at diddlydunpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dun. Meaty, not runny. Top breeders recommend it because it's solid nourishment for the ears.